Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. I'm Tim Wyatt, and this is the episode really picking up on what we talked about last week, which was all about prenatal screening, the different technologies that are now being used, particularly here in the UK and the NHS, offered to pregnant women to test for various conditions before the child is born, and some of the challenges and ethical dilemmas that they throw up. You mentioned in passing, John, last week that you didn't really think that knowledge was always automatically a good thing. Could you explain a bit more about why that is? Because I think that might strike people as a slightly odd thing to say, particularly as a scientist, you know, devoted to discovering more knowledge.
Yes, and I think this is an interesting thing, because it's a distinction between a kind of a modern secular liberal perspective, which tends to see truth and knowledge as an unalloyed good, and a more nuanced position as a Christian, which sees in a fallen world knowledge can actually be very damaging, and therefore there is both a place for confidentiality. I mean, it is interesting that it was the Hippocratic group of physicians back in the ancient world who were really the first to recognize that confidential medical information could, if that was released into the society as a whole, could be extremely damaging. And therefore, part of the Hippocratic Oath was that I will treat all information that I become privy to because of my work as a physician as a most holy secret. And ever since then, medical confidentiality has been seen as an incredibly important way of protecting patients from harm. So there's a recognition right from there that some information cannot be just released into the public domain. That great harm can be done, and I think it's a similar kind of idea that understanding the future isn't an unalloyed good. I mean, just do a thought experiment. Suppose that by doing some kind of test or scan, I could predict with almost 100% accuracy when you were going to die and what you were going to die from. You know, would you like to have the result of that scan? And I think when you put it like that, you start to think, well, what effect is that knowledge going to have on my life? You know, is that going to be a good thing? Is it going to help me to really live a full life and knowing how I'm going to die and when I'm going to die? And I think in a fallen world, knowledge about the future, which is often what genetics gives us, is a kind of an unhelpful thing. And it is fascinating to me that in the biblical narrative, predicting the future in any kind of specific way is actually seen as a negative thing. It's part of soothsaying. God's people are told not to go to magicians and necromancers who are going to tell you about the future. So there's a distinction between prophecy, which is seeing the broad outlines of God's plans and purposes for the future, versus this kind of soothsaying, which is seen as actually a negative and destructive kind of activity. And I just wonder whether predictive genetics, this ability to predict what the future holds by using genetics, it has an aspect of a modern version of soothsaying.
I mean, it strikes me up the front, of course, you know, what was it that Adam and Eve were forbidden from doing? It was from eating the tree, which would give them the knowledge of good and evil. And so from the outset, God recognized that this knowledge which he possessed could be destructive to his creatures made in his image, his new human beings, and for their own good warned them, you don't want that knowledge. You're not supposed to have that knowledge. It's not good for you. But it also strikes me as well, I was when you're listening to you, that there's often phrase that's often banded around is that knowledge is power. But actually in this question of screening and testing, a lot of this knowledge is really powerlessness. It's insight without the ability to change, as you say, that insight about the future without the ability to change the future can be quite toxic, really.
It's a form of determinism, isn't it? And to some extent, it's just false. I mean, the idea of genetic determinism, you know, this idea that my entire life and future just depends on the precise nature of my genetic code. It's just rubbish. It's completely false, but it's an idea which is very potent. And of course, that's even true. You know, if you using prenatal testing discover that your unborn baby has Down syndrome, that doesn't tell you what their personality is going to be like or how they're going to respond, whether they'll be very musical, you know, how they live their life. Well, all these things are not determined by your chromosomes. But there is a kind of implication that once we've got the chromosomes, now we know what the future holds.
And I suppose there's also this kind of unwritten assumed assumption that the doctors are simply imparting information and it's just value-free. It's just facts. It's just accurate scientific genetic information. And it's up to the parents to decide what to do with that. But of course, as we discussed last week, really parents aren't remotely equipped to do that, and I imagine a doctor spend a lot of the time saying the test shows your child as X, and the next question is not, thank you doctor, I will go and make my decision. The next question is, well, what do I do? And the doctor is desperately saying, well, that's not really for me to say, but the parent is saying, well, you can't just drop this knowledge bomb on me to say my child has an X percentage chance of having this condition I never heard of and then just walk away. How is that good care?
Yeah, and this is very much part of how we understand a doctor-patient relationship. And historically, it was a very paternalistic relationship, a kind of father-child relationship. And you know, I'm the doctor, I'm the father, and you've got this little problem in the test, and don't you worry about it. We'll sort it all out for you, and we'll make the right decisions for you. No need to worry your little head about it, kind of thing. Which is obviously inappropriate in the modern world. But I think what is often replacing it is where the power is completely reversed the other way round, and it becomes a kind of client-technician relationship where I tell you, well, you've got this option, you know, you could have this test, you could have that test, you could have an operation, you know, we can give you the baby, we'll take the baby away if you want. You choose. It's your choice, it's your body, it's your life, it's your pregnancy. And then the problem is, of course, is that how can I make those choices? I don't know. You know, I'd need to go away and read every textbook before I could make any choice. So I think a better model, a third way, if you like, is an expert-expert relationship where I, the physician, am supposed to be the expert in terms of the diagnosis and the genetics and the possible implications and what other investigations are available. But you are the expert in terms of your life, your philosophy, your history, your family, the things that really matter to you. And the task is that for us to meet together as experts with mutual respect and to try to find a way forward of consensus. And I'm sharing my expertise. And that may include, you know, if you ask me, well, what would you do, doctor, in this situation? I'll say, well, if you really want to know, this is how I would face it. But in the end, it's going to be your choice. You have to make that decision.
And did that happen in your own practice? I mean, you must have had lots of agonizing conversations with parents who had been told something unexpected about their newborn child. And did they ever ask you, well, what would you do in my shoes? And did you avoid the question? Did you have to just say, do you know what? Here's what I would do.
Yeah, I did. I wouldn't answer it immediately. I would push back slightly and say, you know, I think before I answer that question, I think you need to think some more about, you know, what really matters to you, you know, and you may think this, you may think that, and so on. But in the end, if it was clear that somebody really would not say, well, I will tell you, this is if this was our situation, this is what we would do. And in the case of a child who was diagnosed with severe disabilities, I'd say we would carry on the pregnancy if this was our child, and we would try to make sure that the baby had every possible treatment and care after birth. And even if that meant that the baby was going to die within a few hours or days, we would still do everything we could possibly to care and love for our baby. But in the end, I would then say, that would be my choice, but the question is, what's your choice? That's the decision you have to make.
And I think that, from my perspective as a non-healthcare professional, someone who is, you know, a recipient of treatment rather than someone delivering it, that's actually what I want. I mean, that feels like in my lifetime, the NHS has been kind of gripped by this patient choice mantra, which has a lot of positives, but has really puts you in an awkward spot. I mean, I remember a few years ago going with someone to A&E on the advice of, you know, NHS 111 after we rang up, because they were having some unusual kind of heart and quality of symptoms. And after a long wait, we finally get shown to the doctor, and he kind of reads the notes and then turns and says, well, right, what would you like me to do? And there was this long pause, and I was like, well, I think we're here to find out.
That's what
we're here for.
That's what we've come for.
It was this totally bizarre, like, punting the ball back to us. And I'm like, you spent 20 years honing your craft and understanding the body, so I don't need to know how to treat myself. I'm here to be treated by the expert. And not, as you say, not in a paternalistic kind of patronizing way, but you can swing. I wonder if we've overcorrected and gone too far the other way.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think the idea of the physician as a wise friend, you know, what you want is someone who you feel is on your side, and who is bringing wisdom and knowledge to the table, but is not going to dominate and coerce, but is going to be there, someone you can lean on, someone you can feel is committed to you and your best interests. And I think you're right. I think there was very definitely a phase in the NHS when the medicine was being compared to a service industry. You know, we're basically just providing a similar service to supermarkets or to any other customer facing service industry, and therefore, you know, the most important thing is that the customer is always right. You know, whatever you want, it's always there for you, and we want people to complain, because complaints are really important, because that's the way we improve our service. And there was a phase when NHS management was filled with this kind of service industry approach. And of course, the whole point is that healthcare is not like a supermarket, and therefore, it's a very inappropriate model. However attractive it is in a certain sort of liberal free market economy.
To Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And so, coming back to the kind of thinking about prenatal screening as Christians, do you think, therefore, we touched on this briefly last episode, but do you think, therefore, a healthy way, if you're a Christian and you're personally convinced that it wouldn't be right to abort a child because they had a disability, that other than the kind of ultrasound and the other and things like that, that you can actually do something about, the healthiest, easiest option is to say, you know, when I'm offered the choice on my menu of services, to say no thank you to the NIPT and no thank you to X, Y, and Z other tests that may become available.
Yeah, I think there are two separate things there. One is there are some people who say, yeah, I hear the argument that this, you know, that every life is precious and it's special, but actually, you know, surely it is true that for some people born with disabilities and congenital abnormalities, that they do face terrible suffering. They face years of treatment and invasive, unpleasant experiences. And why is it wrong to, out of compassion, to say we should end that life? It's not saying anything about disability in general. It's simply saying that the compassionate thing to do, if you know that your child is going to have a life full of suffering, is to have an abortion. So there certainly are Christians, including some of my good friends that I've talked privately about this, where they have said, and I know they have on occasion had abortions, but when a diagnosis of a serious fetal abnormality was made. So I think there are Christian arguments that are made in that direction. I think the other argument that is sometimes said is that I'm not planning to have an abortion, but I would like to prepare myself.
Yes.
And therefore, by having the test, I can prepare myself. I can go through the rest of the pregnancy planning and preparing for this baby who has special needs, and that is a valuable and important role.
I can see the thinking there, though I suppose it does. It's almost dangling the forbidden fruit in front of you, isn't it? It's giving it. If the test comes back positive for one of these conditions, even if you were initially were at the outset said, do you know what, I don't believe in abortion for disability, and I just want to be prepared. When you have that knowledge, and then you have to sit day by day, week by week, and you know, in the UK you can abort all the way up to a term for disability, so there's no cutoff. I wonder whether the temptation, such maybe that's the wrong word, hangs over you like that. It becomes a challenge, and balancing that stress over the ability to, as you say, prepare in advance is an interesting one. But I think what I struggle with, the initial argument, the kind of argument from compassion, as it were, that you know, why would we bring children into the world who we think are going to suffer from a terrible condition? It strikes me as relatively self-centered, because really the parent is saying, I imagine that my child, should they be born with disability, would rather they were dead. But in truth, that they don't know that. And I'm pretty confident if you actually go and talk to people who are alive today with disabilities, none of them say, do you know what, I wish my mum or dad had aborted me before I was born.
Yes, and this is what is sometimes called the disability paradox, which has been repeatedly investigated and demonstrated. And that is that if you ask somebody who doesn't have a physical disability to imagine that they, for instance, were living life in a wheelchair, or that they were blind, or they had some other severe physical impairment or disability, and then to say, what do you think your quality of life would be? How do you think you would respond in that? Most people say, oh, it would be very negative. You know, it would be horrible. I mean, to imagine spending the whole of your life in a wheelchair, or spending the whole of your life with that problem, it would just be terrible. It would be horrific. My life would be horrific. But when you then interview people who are actually in that situation, and you say, can you describe what your life is? People with disabilities, including those with sometimes very severe disabilities, actually tend to give a very positive statement of the value of their life, and say, actually, you know, yes, I have frustrations, but then who doesn't have frustrations? But actually, there are so many positive things about my life, and I really enjoy this, and I look forward to that, and most of the time, I'm not spending my time thinking of only I didn't have this impairment. In fact, what many disabled people say, my real problem is not so much the disability itself. My real problem is social responses. It's other people's responses to my disability. It's how society responds to me. That's my real problem. That's what really causes me difficulty.
Yeah, this is the kind of social model of disability, isn't it? Which says that, you know, we see the person in the wheelchair and think, gosh, how awful their life must be. Their life is inevitably going to be terrible because they can't use their legs. But actually, if the world was full of ramps and lifts, they would, their lack of capacity in their legs would be less, or potentially even no big deal at all. And so that their disability is actually a product of society, not a product of their physiology, which I think can be overstated, but is certainly a powerful and compelling kind of way to flip the thinking of disability on its head. Think about it, as you say, through the eyes of the disabled rather than from the kind of paternalistic, able-bodied people looking down on them.
Yes, and what's worse is that what is then suggested is that the medical profession are really implementing society's prejudices against disabled people, so that instead of changing society so that it's more accepting of disabled people and making sure that people with wheelchairs and with visual impairments and so on are being able to live their lives normally, instead of doing that, we're employing medical technology and medical specialists in order to try to eliminate people before birth who have these disabilities. So we're just implementing a kind of societal prejudice against disabled people. I mean, it's an extreme version of putting it. And certainly my experience of talking to parents who've been in this sort of appalling, agonising dilemma is none of that is relevant, really, or none of that tends to come out in the conversation. What comes out is much more this worry about suffering. And you're right that you could argue that this is all subjective and not based in reality. But I do know that for many parents, this is a very real and painful decision. And they often feel that they're left with an impossible decision. Now you've given me this information, doctor. I remember one woman saying to me very vehemently, she said, "You've put me in an impossible decision. Either I am responsible for bringing this child with severe problems into the world, or I am responsible for killing my baby." I mean, what kind of choice is that? Hmm. And you can see how the pain that lies behind that kind of decision. And that's really why I think there is an argument that better not to know and better not to have that decision forced on you.
I think what frustrates me in some of my more kind of cynical and intemperate moments is that I hear a lot of the language from people who have chosen, or who say they would hypothetically choose to have an abortion should they be given a kind of diagnosis of some kind of abnormality or genetic condition. And it's always phrased in the compassion, you know, it wouldn't be fair to bring this person who would suffer, you know, they wouldn't have a good life, and wouldn't it be better for everyone? And I just can't, I have this niggling doubt in the back of my mind that really subconsciously what they actually are is, I don't want to be the parent to a disabled child. I think that sounds like hell. And that is not something I signed up for when I wanted to have a baby. And so let's start from scratch and wipe the slate clean. But that it's a bit too brutal to be honest and say it out loud. And so they frame the argument around the needs of the child as an unconscious psychological defense against admitting to themselves actually they're too afraid, or dare I say even potentially a little too selfish, to be the parent of a disabled child.
Well, I think there's a lot in what you say, except that it isn't going on at a conscious level.
No.
I think, in fact, there is very deep sort of suppressed emotions and feelings often in these kind of dilemmas. And I think this is revealed in the interesting evidence that shows that there is a significant incidence of distress and psychological problems, depression and so on, following abortion. But what's very interesting to me is that all the evidence shows that it's significantly higher, the risk of and the incidence of depression, psychological upset, and long-lasting psychological problems, it's higher when an abortion is being carried out for a fetal abnormality than when it's being carried out for a so-called social abortion. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there were many people who might say, well, I think a social abortion for no reason, that's quite wrong. But an abortion for fetal abnormality, yes, I can understand why that would be the right decision. Mm. And yet it's those decisions that seem to have a greater incidence of psychiatric and psychological distress. And I think it reflects this exactly the kind of conflicting emotion. You know, am I genuinely, when I've decided to end the life of my child, am I genuinely acting in their best interests? Am I genuinely doing it for them? Or was I being selfish? Am I protecting myself? And is that what a mother should do, to put her own interests before those of her child? And after I've had the abortion, then I see a child with Down syndrome walking down the street with their parents, and I suddenly think, gosh, is that what my child would have looked like? And did I do the right thing? And that child looks very happy, and would my child have been happy? And so there's a very complex kind of mix there of deep psychological forces and emotion. And I know that counsellors like Celia, my wife, who've been involved in counselling women, often in these situations, often it takes weeks of sort of exploration and patient listening and sharing and sometimes crying together to really come to a place of understanding and reconciliation about some of these very, very painful decisions.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. Clearly, I mean, we always act with mixed motives, don't we? And who can honestly kind of, with any of the weighty decision of this nature, honestly go backwards and pick through, you know, what is genuine self-reflection and what was my real instigating factor here and what was just me kind of erecting psychological defences because I don't want to believe that I am the kind of person who would do X, Y, and Z. And that's the kind of thing that needs to be worked out in therapy over many, many weeks, months, years even, I suppose.
Yeah, I think one of the really interesting and positive things that's happening is the development of what is sometimes called disability theology of an understanding that instead of this entirely negative view, this view that human beings are meant to be perfect, and then to the degree to which we're all disabled, that is a kind of negative and almost subhuman way of existing, and historically sometimes that's been a kind of theological perspective. I know that in the distant past, the birth of a child with malformations was sometimes seen as a sort of portent, a sign from God of some judgment or some other. So it's very much this person with disabilities, this child was seen as an other, as a sort of strange, almost subhuman entity. There's been much more recently a very much more positive move to seeing that disabled people within the community sometimes seem to reflect something very precious and unique, far from it being a negative and subhuman existence. They're often people with disabilities, with learning difficulties, are bringing something into our society as a unique reflection, a revelation of God himself.
I think that's really true, and it's one of the things that's particularly acute. I know this example we keep using when you come back to Down syndrome, because I think at the same time, tragically, that the kind of abortion rates have been ticking up and fewer Down syndrome children are being born, actually those who are living with Down syndrome are having better and better outcomes. And you know, we used to think of Down syndrome as this kind of horrendous crippling disability, would put children in kind of homes and they would die in their teens or early 20s, and now I think life expectancy for someone with Down syndrome is in its 50s and is increasing all the time, and there is a rise of people often refer to them as self-advocates. I think of a lovely Christian woman called Heidi Krauter, who's been doing quite a lot of activism in the UK around abortion rules on disability. And she's someone with Down syndrome who lives independently and is married and is a really, you know, I've seen interviews of her as a really charming, engaging person, speaks very passionately and obviously very truthfully out of her own experience on this issue. And it's on one level, it's really wonderful to see, as you say, how people's thinking is shifting on disability and that we are recognizing how much they contribute, how what the richness to the family of God's people they bring. And at the same time, you know, we're aborting more and more of them before they have a chance to grow into these to the self-advocates and these huge benefits to society that they could be.
That's absolutely right. I had the privilege of meeting Heidi Krauter just a few weeks ago. I acted as an expert witness in the case where she there was a judicial review about the law on the abortion of Down syndrome and other fetuses with abnormality, and which she undertook. And I met her at a conference, and she, as you say, is absolutely remarkable lady, full of life and laughter and certainly there's no doubt that an understanding that people who are different from us can actually bring a richness into the human community, and that our calling is to love and accept and respect them and learn from them as much as we can pass on to them as well. So I'm looking towards the future. I'm positive. I think, yes, there are some really challenging questions coming. And as genetic science advances, and particularly as this kind of free market in genetic testing is increasing, I think something we're going to come back to in future podcasts to look at what the implications are of the advancing genetic science and so on. But I do think the rise of disability theology, the much greater and positive awareness of how much we have to learn from people with disabilities, and the importance of Christian communities welcoming and accepting and being open towards people with disabilities. I think we've a lot to learn, and there does feel a sense we're making progress in this very important area.
Mm. And just lastly, then it makes me wonder what difference it would make people's decisions if, you know, in every time they were sitting in a room and receiving the confirmation that their unborn child had Down syndrome, as well as speaking to a doctor, they were also able to speak to someone like Heidi, you know, with that's more knowledge, more facts, but telling a slightly different story to the one, perhaps the kind of medicalized testing story that we discussed earlier.
Well, exactly, and that's something that I and others have pushed for. And there is a slogan from the disability rights movement which says nothing about us without us. And so you would say, well, prenatal screening is definitely about people with disabilities, and therefore they should be there and they should be involved. The interesting thing is that many medical professionals actually push back about that. And they feel bizarrely that it would be manipulative or coercive or insensitive to encourage people to meet adults and children with Down syndrome or families looking after children with Down syndrome if they are wrestling with this question about prenatal diagnosis. So it's because choice and freedom of choice is seen as the supreme good, and this sort of rather paternalistic view that we mustn't influence that choice in any coercive or unhelpful way.
So only some additional forms of knowledge are good, then. They're effectively conceding there, aren't they? The knowledge from the test is good, but the knowledge of lived experience from someone who's had Down syndrome would be too upsetting, too coercive.
Well, there is a curious mix of paternalism and liberalism in the medical profession, I'm afraid.
Something to dig into in future episodes, no doubt. But we've run out of time again. Thanks, John. It's been a really interesting and thought-provoking discussion. I hope you guys listening at home have enjoyed it as well. there's lots more on John's website, johnwhite.com, about some of these issues around prenatal screening, abortion, fetal abnormality. That was a large part of his kind of medical practice. And I also must point out the book which gives this podcast its very name, also called Matters of Life and Death, which is a great read. It has a whole chapter on prenatal screening, fetal screening, and the quest for the healthy baby, which is a lot more information and some interesting studies that kind of further elucidate these issues. So I recommend getting a copy of Matters of Life and Death, the book, if you can. There are links on John's website where you can buy that. But thanks for listening. As always, you can get in touch with us. Just email molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll see you next week. Thank you.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, promo code STAPLE20.